One of the things that we know about people over time and culture is that they have always created rituals to mark important transitions, to mark things that happen in life, the good, the bad. And we still have those things. We still have those rituals, maybe not as many as we once did, but we have them. The problem for a lot of people is that even if there are kind of family rituals that they have practiced or they practiced when they were young, sometimes they just don't tend to work as the world changes, as we get older. We still feel the need for them, but often people say, well, you know, I'm just really not quite sure how to do this anymore now that I'm a grown up, maybe now that I have my own family. That's what we'll be talking about here this morning in this part of Focus 580, the relationship between family resiliency and ritual, family ritual. And our guest for the program is Dr. Evan Imber Black. She is very well known as a family therapist and has written a lot and spoken a lot about families and ritual and how those two things come together. In fact, she is the co-author of a book that was published a few years back but is still available, which is titled Rituals for Our Times, the subtitle Celebrating, Healing, and Changing Our Lives and Our Relationships. And the current publisher is Jason Aronson. It's a paperback. It is out in the bookstore, so if you're interested in looking at it, you can certainly look for this book. She's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. She gave a talk yesterday sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. And over time, some of their speakers have been here on the show, and we're happy that they could help us to talk with Evan Imber Black. And as we do talk, you're certainly welcome to call in with questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about her. She is a teaching faculty member of the Ackerman Institute for the Family. That's in New York. She's also director of the Family and Group Studies Program and professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, also in New York City. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How is it that you got so interested in this particular subject, that is family rituals?
Mostly through the families that I was seeing in therapy, people who came to us, couples therapy, family therapy, and discovering in talking to them how important the rituals in their lives were, whether these were daily rituals, things like meals, bedtime rituals for children, how you say hello in the morning and goodbye, and how you say hello again at the end of the day, or the larger rituals that we're into in this season, the holidays, things like Thanksgiving, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, and so forth, or the life cycle rituals, the major life cycle rituals that mark those transitions from one stage of life to the other. And we just found in talking to families that these were critical to their well-being.
When you use a term like ritual, that makes it sound like it's something awfully big and involved. And I think that there are probably a lot of things that would actually qualify that people would say, well, I don't know that I would exactly call that ritual. But when you think about it, that in fact it is. What exactly qualifies as ritual?
What we look at is does the event or the activity have to it symbols, and those can be, you know, little small symbols, or they can be the very large symbols in our lives that are capable of carrying multiple meanings for families, so not just one meaning but many meanings. Does it have what we call symbolic action, meaning all of the sort of dramatic parts? For instance, when a child graduates high school, we don't just say to them, you've graduated. We put them through a very elaborate ceremony where they walk down an aisle and they walk across a stage and they take the tassel from one side of the mortarboard and they put it to the other side, all symbolizing that now they've graduated. And so that's what we call symbolic action. And that it occurs in special time, not just any old any time, and that it occurs in special space. So, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, it would have been very odd if somebody had gone out in the backyard and fired up the barbecue and brought in steaks, right? This was the day for a turkey. So, special time. And then the special space can be your living room, your kitchen, a church, a synagogue, a mosque, your backyard. But that it is space that when you enter enter it, you know you're entering something different for that moment in time. And then finally, that it be, on the one hand, somewhat structured, somewhat anchored in where we've come from before, and has room for spontaneity, for something new to happen, for something different to happen that accounts for the changes that are going on in families all the time. And mm-hmm. those are the things that we call ritual.
My guess is that while probably all families still have some, that there are fewer than there have been in the past. Maybe we don't spend quite as much time. And I guess I'm thinking about the fact that people are, families are extreme, will say that they're extremely busy, they're rushed, they're stressed, and that families are spread out now, so that it can be sometimes really difficult to get people together, which is, of course, one of those things that can create a lot of stress and mm-hmm. pressure, because if those things don't happen, if you don't have many of them, if you only have a few of them throughout the year, then that puts greater weight on the few that you do have. Do you think that it is in fact true that we give over less time to ritual now than maybe we did a half century ago, maybe?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think, first of all, the important thing in my mind would not be the quantity anyway. It would be, the quality. But we certainly encompass in what we're looking at all of the daily rituals that people do, the meals, the mm-hmm. get-togethers in the evening, the sitting down with a child for a short period of time for reading, whatever those daily things might be that mark a connecting point, a point of cohesion in the family. And then the larger ones, I mean, I think they're obviously still there. In fact, in some ways we're adding them. If you look at a holiday like Kwanzaa that never existed before 30 years ago or 40 years ago now and was then invented to fill a need in the African-American community. But I think people are doing them differently. They may not be doing them with weeks of cooking ahead of time or this type of thing. Maybe they order in some of the food and make some of the food themselves. So there is a change required by the fact that both parents, if it's a two-parent family, are working outside the home.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that would be encouraging if what people are saying is we recognize that this time together is important and that we also recognize that the point of it is being together and that all the other stuff, well, maybe we can make that other part a little easier and place not so much importance on that, and then say what's really important is that we're together.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of the things that we encourage families to be thinking about. What if we take the large holiday rituals that we're all in the context of at this moment? One of the things that we really encourage is for families to sit down together before a holiday and ask themselves, what do we want it to be? Now, let's not just get caught up in the juggernaut of what the television and the shopping mall and so on is telling us it should be, but what did we do last year? What did we like about it? What did we hate about it? And we never want to see it again as long as we live. So that the ritual itself becomes more meaningful in a personal way for each family and their own little mini culture.
Yeah. I guess that is one of the challenges that people continue to do the same things over and over again because that's the way they've done it. And that there may be indeed some attachment to the way that it has always been done, so that somebody might suggest doing something different and you'd say, no, we can't,
right.
We can't do that because we've always done it this other way. But then if you always do the same thing in the same way, then it could get to the point where it's lost something. It doesn't feel special anymore. Maybe we start to feel like we're just going through the motions.
That's right. No, I think that's where, again, we look and we encourage families to look for that balance between structure, which anchors you to where you come from, the kind of things that maybe your grandmother did, and room for something new to happen. Because rituals that are only the way they've always been go dead. They grow boring. People don't want to participate anymore. They lose their meaning. And families are dynamic organisms. They're constantly changing. Somebody enters the family. Somebody gets married. A new child is born. Somebody gets ill. Somebody dies. There's a divorce. And so the rituals have to reflect that. If they don't, then they lose their felt meaning for people.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, again, I'd like to introduce Dr. Evan Imber-Black. She teaches at the Ackerman Institute for the Family in New York City. She's also director of the Family and Group Studies Program and professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City, and has written a lot, has done a lot of speaking about family, and particularly this thing that we're talking here before, ritual, family rituals, and why it is they're important, and how it is that people, if they feel that the rituals they have don't do it for them, that it's possible to make new ones. And as I mentioned, she's co-authored a book on this subject that if you're interested in exploring it, you could perhaps take a look at it. The book is titled Rituals for Our Times. It's out in paper, has been out a number of years. It was when did you write this?
1992.
Okay. So it has been out for a while, but is still available. And so you can head down to the bookstore and take a look at it, or in the library. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something I think also we know that happens is that people, as they grow up, can somehow feel estranged not only from their family, but also from family rituals. That is, as you know, something that they might have participated in as a child and worked perfectly well as a child. Once they got to be an adult, they will say, you know, this doesn't work for me anymore. And I imagine probably some of those people, rather than finding some new way, they just don't do anything at all.
I think that's true. I think the idea that you can change rituals is perhaps something that people don't always think about. And it's certainly not our message that you should take what you had and throw it all away and then, you know, start from scratch, although some people may want to do that, so much as looking at what you had, taking what still works for you, and then adding something new. I mean, when you think about it, any time two people come together to form a new relationship, they're each coming from families that did things differently. Mm-hmm. Even if they're the same religion, the same cultural group, there are some differences. And so there has to be some period of negotiation, some period of creating a new equilibrium for how are we going to do this in a way that feels right for our family. And it takes a period of time. It may take a period of years. And particularly with these larger rituals, I think one of the ideas is to, you know, in a spirit of experimentation, try one or two things a little differently. See if you like it. If you don't like it, you don't have to do it again. It's not precedent setting. But rather than throwing off the whole thing, which you're right, I mean, sometimes people do that, we find that often that's a kind of developmental stage, particularly as people go through adolescence. They don't want to do the things the way the family did it. And if their parents can tolerate that for a period of time and not get into huge struggles, they will probably come back around to some things that still feel meaningful and warm and touching while adding new things that are reflective of where they are in life at this period in time.
Yeah. I would imagine that for people like that, one of the things that happens in their life that changes the way they think about ritual is when they have children.
Well, exactly. And that's often the time when people, even who've stopped doing any rituals, especially these larger holiday rituals, begin to think, you know, maybe there's something to this that I want to pass on to my children.
Mm-hmm. It's, I think one of the things that we know is that times like this, when families come together, can be extremely stressful. And just recently I talked with someone who was a psychologist who has written about that subject. And in fact, he wrote this book called When Bad Relatives Happen to Good People. and generally the idea was, you know, why it is that sometimes that holiday time, family gatherings, occasions like this can be very stressful. And then his suggestions for people for, you know, just making it a little bit easier to deal with. Why is it that it seems like these times like these, that particularly those that are happy times, where we feel part of us says, well, we, you know, we should be having a good time here. This is the most wonderful time of the year. Everybody tells us so. The culture tells us so. And yet, if we're sitting there thinking, you know, I'm not having very much fun here, why is it that these kinds of times can be so difficult?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. I mean, one, any of these holiday rituals, first of all, require work. Elves don't come and put the dinner out for most of us. And so who's going to do the work? Is it all going to fall on one person? Is it all going to fall on the woman who may be working outside the home? And then she's got this extra thing to do. And so there's that piece of it. And so some anticipation about if we're going to do this in a good way, what is the work and how do we divvy it up in a way that feels fair and just and also, you know, useful to us? I think also for many families, there may be expectations of what this is supposed to be that are shaped by what do you see on television, what do you see at the shopping mall, that can easily overwhelm your own ideas. And so that takes some doing to say, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do it the way the magazine says we should do it. We're going to do it the way our family feels we should do it. Then, of course, there are all kinds of interpersonal struggles that may be going on in a family at a given point in time that need to be factored in. There may be arguments between people or cutoffs where people aren't seeing each other, and then suddenly on Christmas they're supposed to be having a good time together. Those issues, we believe, need to be addressed outside of the holiday context. The Christmas dinner is not the time to try to settle some old score or to reveal a secret or anything, you know, along those lines. So there's a number of things like that, I think, that need to be taken into consideration, along with how can we make this something that each of us have a voice in. I think in many families, the work all falls on one person, and sometimes the tradition all falls to one side so that you're only doing the Christmas that is your husband's family's Christmas. And it doesn't feel right to you. It doesn't feel, you know, like you are really a participant. And so I think accounting for that, trying to take a look at how can we do this in a way that takes what may be rich and meaningful from each of the families we come from and discarding what no longer kind of fits for us.
Mm-hmm. I'd like the idea of if you do have a family that everybody should have an opportunity to participate, and so that I guess ideally every one of them should be, you should say, well, think about what to you is really important. Mm-hmm. What do you really want to do? And that everybody should get to put in a couple of things that they say, look, this is really important to me. This is what I really want to do. And not just I just want to do this thing, but I would like us all to do this thing.
That's right. And I think, you know, if you do it that way, and even young children love rituals. They're sort of natural ritual makers. They love the pageantry and the colors and the foods and, you know, things like that. And so figuring out, well, what can they participate in? Maybe it's coloring placemats. Maybe it's, you know, helping to do cookies or whatever it might be. And I like very much your idea of, okay, if each of us could pick one or two things that we would really like everybody to try, that would be a wonderful experiment to see what kind of holiday do we then end up with instead of doing the one that, you know, was maybe there for the last 50 years but doesn't fit for us any longer.
Yeah. I suppose the other part of it, and maybe one of the reasons that holidays sometimes for people are stressful, is that they feel that they have to do so much. They say that we got 100 things that we must do, and that maybe it would make sense to, you know, take a look at your list of 100 things and see if you can knock about 85 of them off.
Absolutely.
And say, okay, now really, what do we have to do? What's really important mm-hmm. here? And just make it a little bit easier mm-hmm. on everybody.
And also, are there things that we're doing that just, you know, we don't really like anymore? You know, we're making some mm-hmm. dish that great grandma made that nobody has eaten for three generations, but it's got to be on the table. Maybe that could go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've sort of touched on this, but I guess I feel like it's probably important to talk about why it is that it's important and why these things really do matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of the research that's been done on family rituals and community rituals show that they give families many, many things. They do a lot of things. They provide a sense of cohesion. They carry us from one stage of life to the next. they help us to heal losses. I spoke last night a bit about some of the rituals connected to 9/11, that one of the things that I was most struck with was that as soon as those towers fell, people were making rituals. All over New York City, you saw missing posters that were, and what were the pictures? They were all pictures of rituals, or most of them, past Christmases, weddings, engagement parties, bar mitzvahs, and so on. And people would put them up and put a message, and then other people in New York City would write messages back, and they became these amazing interactive rituals. 4 days after the towers fell, all over the country, people were standing outside their houses with candles at 7 o'clock at night on Friday night to show a kind of sense of solidarity. So that rituals do an amazing number of things for us. And we found in working with families who had suffered a tragic loss from 9/11 that one of the things they were most concerned about, and this was at a gathering in October, you know, after 9/11, what are we going to do about Thanksgiving? What are we going to do about Christmas? And that was on their minds, you know, in terms of the holidays having such power for people and the idea of how are we going to do this without this member who's so important to us this year. So they are no small thing in our lives, definitely. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you see it in a tragic moment like that.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose that is, I remember after that, I think one of the things that really reverberated through the culture was a lot of people, no matter who they were and what they did, they were saying nothing will ever be the same again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This has changed life forever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was pretty quickly after that we started saying, well, okay, this was an incredible tragic event. We're never going to forget. It has changed things,
mm-hmm.
but it is not the case that nothing is, you know, the world has changed permanently. Nothing will ever be the same again. We are going to get back to life eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But that says something, I suppose, about a huge traumatic event that you do probably think right away. You think, well, nothing is ever going to be the same
again. And one of the things that I think did help people to re-anchor, indeed, were the rituals, both the ones that got created like that and then the more familiar, warm family rituals that people could continue to have. Not the government-imposed ones, not the ones of, you know, let's take all the children and take them to Disney World and those type of things, but the ones that really had ongoing meaning that could connect people to a meaningful past and at the same time help them to see that there was going to be a possible future.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way that you can somehow integrate people who are gone? I mean, people who are actually gone?
Yes, and it's a very important thing. One of the things we found in our research with families is that when there's a loss, a death, and then a holiday coming, people tend to do one of two things most often. And the first being, let's skip the holiday. Let's cancel it this year.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work very well because we're embedded in it right now, right? You can't escape it. And so to try to cancel it, in fact, cuts you off from what could be a point of solace, even though it's not going to be perhaps a point of joy that particular year. The other thing we found people saying to us is, well, we're going to celebrate the same way we always did when Dad was alive. Now, the problem with that, of course, is if you try to do that, then you can't tell all the funny stories about, remember the year Dad knocked over the Christmas tree, and people are on edge, and we're not allowed to talk about it. So we encourage more a way to incorporate points of remembrance, of honoring. Maybe it's a special toast. Maybe it's looking at a video. Maybe it's looking at photographs the night before. a holiday, telling stories about the person and doing the stuff of mourning, what we do, which is to tell stories and not shut it down. And that's how I think those losses get integrated. And then what are the symbols that might still be present? You know, is it grandmother's china? Is it, you know, the candlesticks that they brought from Europe or whatever it might be that still help you to stay connected to that person, even though they're no longer there.
Hmm. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Evan Ember Black. She is a teaching faculty member of the Ackerman Institute for the Family in New York. She also is director of the Family and Group Studies Program and professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. And is here visiting here, give a talk on this very subject yesterday, her visit sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program here at University of Illinois. And she has written a number of books about both about family and about ritual. And if you're interested in this particular topic here we're talking about, one you might look for is her book Rituals for Our Times, Celebrating, Healing, and Changing Our Lives and Our Relationships. That's the subtitle. She wrote this with Janine Roberts, and it is published. It is now out in paperback. It's published by Jason Aronson and came out first in 1998, right?
1992, and then republished in 98.
Okay.
That's okay.
Okay, first came out in 92, and that was HarperCollins.
That's right.
When they published it.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, it's still out there, and if you're interested in looking at the book. And comments and questions here are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess one of the things I'm interested in, maybe this reflects my own experience, is for people, particularly adults, who really just feel estranged from the whole business, finding some way to reconnect with the idea of holiday, with the idea of ritual. And, you know, for some now at this time of year, some people that's going to be Christmas. Not everybody celebrates Christmas, mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's something else for them, but who really just feel like they would just like to, you know, go home and close the door and hide out for a while until the holiday dies down. And, you know, then they'll get on with it. And I guess, you know, I should say that's kind of the way I feel about it myself. And what do you do for somebody like me?
Well, I guess I'd need to know more. You know, I'd need to know what is there about this time of year that is a turnoff. You know, perhaps not for you, but for a lot of people, certainly there are difficult family relationships that get refocused on at this time of year. Maybe there's people who aren't speaking to each other, and so the idea of having a holiday together seems ridiculous, or whatever. You know, there'd be many, many reasons, or perhaps somebody came from a family where it was very oppressive, where you had to do the ritual in a particular way, and there was no room for multiple voices and new ideas. So, I mean, I think it's sort of reflecting on all of that, and or maybe it's just, you know, it's too much fuss and bother, and so that what you want to look at is some way to perhaps simplify, if you're drawn to that. And, you know, I mean, if you're not, I think that has to be okay too.
Well, I think in my case that's part of it.
Uh-huh.
But I also think, well, I do think probably for me, and I think for a lot of people, it does go back to one of the things you talked about earlier, and that is the horrible clash between expectations and reality.
Yeah.
And that it is particularly something that comes to us through popular culture,
right.
That we, you know, so many expectations, so much stuff is laid on this, and that no matter how, even if it's fine, and you know, I have a fine family, and I don't mind spending time with them, that's not so much the issue. I think perhaps it is something. It does have something to do with the massive expectation,
mm-hmm.
and that it's just not like that.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing, and to maybe ask yourself, whose holiday is this anyway, right? Does it belong to, again, sort of the commercial establishments, or does it belong to your family? I think is a big question, and to tone it down, if that, you know, and to question the expectations, and to say to yourselves, you know, how do we want it to be? Does it have to be this, you know, Martha Stewart Christmas, or can it be ours? I think is an important question.
Yeah. Poor Martha. Yeah. We have a caller here to talk with in Chicago on our line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hi. First, I wanted to say thank you for this. It's sort of like a sane holiday series you've been having on. I've noticed a theme over the past couple of weeks, and I really appreciate it, because my mantra for this Christmas has been enough is enough. I think one thing that always happens, especially for women, is that we end up trying to overcompensate. And it just occurred to me that a Christmas was supposed to be an alternative celebration to the Roman feasting and the Roman excess of orgies. And instead, we've turned it back into an orgy where you can't get enough food, you can't give enough food, you can't give enough creature comforts. You can't get enough sleep because there are back-to-back parties. It's almost unpleasant. And in my own home, we've definitely said enough is enough, and we've been scaling back, mainly brought on because one relative got the shingles by New Year's last year as a result of just trying to do too much. And I don't know exactly what we can do, but I'm beginning to feel more and more that instead of being alternative celebration to excess, Christmas has become the excess.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like you're thinking this through very carefully and logically with your own family to have something that's meaningful but that doesn't conform to whatever these societal expectations are, and I commend you for that.
Well, thank you, and again, thanks, David, for having these programs.
Sure. We certainly have time for other questions, comments. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if you would be listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And in fact, anyone who might just happen to be listening over the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you could listen. You could also use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Is it possible to invent new rituals?
Well, it is. I mean, if you look at something like Kwanzaa, for instance, a lot of people think Kwanzaa came from Africa. It did not. A man named Ron Karenga, a professor out in Southern California, started the tradition of Kwanzaa in the 1960s, and it took off as something that I think met some needs in certain segments of the African American community, and it's become quite anchored as a holiday in December that many African American families celebrate. So yes, it is possible to create new rituals, and they might be something large like Kwanzaa, or it might be something very small, just for your own family, that no other family does.
Mm-hmm. I guess that again goes to the heart of the idea that ritual, what part of what ritual does is it says, this is who we are.
That's right. It does express our identity, yeah. Unquestionably. It expresses our beliefs. It is a way to announce we are this kind of family, or this kind of community, or this kind of ethnic group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we've got another caller here in locally in Champaign. Let's talk with them on line 1.
Yes, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make one comment. This is a season to be jolly, not frantic. And we've turned it into frantic and panic. And I'll hang up and listen to your response. And thank you for your insights.
All right. Again, thank you for the call.
Yeah.
I know we have talked about that, but it seems to me that's an important idea to get across, and I think that's probably one of the particularly at this time in this period, you know, say as one is approaching Thanksgiving up to the end of the year, when a lot of people do celebrate these holidays, and I think that's what it is that people talk about most, that is feeling that there are so many, life has become so complicated, there are so many things that need to get done. And then in addition to that, we say, now because of this, because of these holidays, because of this special time, there are more things mm-hmm. that we need to do. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the thing that more and more I think people talk about, is just feeling that there's just, I can't possibly do all this. And even if I'm supposed to be having fun, if have fun, you know, have holiday fun is at the top of the list, that probably can become just as difficult as all those other things that you know, all those other commitments that you have to take care of too.
Well, I think especially if it's a commandment, right, that you shall have fun,
yes.
It's probably not going to work. There are families, you know, and I think this is part of our message, that it needs to work for your family. There are families that like the frantic kind of thing, and if that works for them, then that's how they should do it. There are other families that need things much more simple. There are, you know, within one couple, there may be one partner who likes it more frenetic and one who likes it quieter, and there needs to be some adaptations made so that each can get some of their needs met.
Mm. We have been talking, I suppose, a lot about at least some rituals that are happy, or that they're supposed to be happy. And there are also rituals connected with life events that are not mm-hmm. happy. There are certainly rituals that are about coping with loss. And maybe those aren't the ones that we talk about quite as much. And, you know, maybe those, maybe they're also the ones that we avoid. We try to avoid thinking about that because we'd rather not. What's the importance of ritual when there's some kind of an occasion that's not happy?
Well, if you're thinking, for instance, of a loss, a death, something like that, throughout history, cultures have made significant rituals to mark that time. To create a context of grieving, I think in the sense that human beings will need this. So whether it's a week, a month, whatever, you know, period of time that different religious groups have marked off, or a year, you know, that some religions have, where you are considered to be in a different time, in a different context, a context of loss and mourning. And the fact that this has existed throughout time, I think, tells us something, that this is a very important transition from life to death, to the survivors' need to integrate the loss, to go on with living, and that it's these rituals that help us to do that, and that then help us to mark some kind of memory, whether it's at a year anniversary or whatever it might be. You will see this across the world and throughout time, that people have made rituals to mark those kinds of losses. I think it gives people a sense of connection to their family, to their community, sense of cohesion, support. Most mourning rituals that we looked at, one of the very important things is that the mourner is not left alone, that there's a community support that comes around the person, and not allowing a kind of isolation that could then be problematic. So there's a kind of wisdom, I think, that's come down through the ages with these rituals. And again, we're living in a time when there's certainly some challenge to that. I don't know if you've ever heard or read about drive-through funeral visiting. It's in California, not here, where it's just what it sounds like. You drive up to a computer screen, you type up the name of the deceased, they flash a picture of the coffin on the screen, you type your name in that you've been there, and you go back to work. Now, there's something wrong with that, I think, and it reflects this fast-forward culture that we're living in, and that I think we need to take a stand about and say that's not the way to do it.
Yeah, our guest is Evan Ember Black. She has written a lot, does a lot of speaking about families. We're talking about the importance of ritual. Again, if you're interested in reading about this and thinking about it, you might take a look at a book that she co-authored with Janine Roberts titled Rituals for Our Times. And questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So much of this ritual, special occasions, holidays, and ways of dealing life in life transitions is anchored in religion, in the spiritual part of people's lives. But I think also one of the things that we have seen is that so much of this has become increasingly secularized. The religious part has been taken out. I know that some people would say that that's bad. I'm not exactly sure one way or another. What do you think about that, and whether taking the spiritual part out somehow makes the ritual less, or can you do it and achieve the same sort of goals with the ritual if you don't have that other part?
Again, it's so variable. You know, it's family to family. For some families, the spiritual part of especially Christmas or Hanukkah is extremely important. For other families, it's more the sort of pageantry and the fun and that part of it. I think bottom line, does it give your family a sense of who you are, of who you want to be, of what the values are of your family? It should reflect that. And so if that's through religion, that may be one way. If it's more secular, that may be another way. We look, for instance, at a holiday like Thanksgiving, which is predominantly secular. It's not attached to a particular religion. And one of the interesting things about Thanksgiving is that when people migrate to the United States, it's the first holiday that they celebrate. And they may do it with all kinds of wonderful side dishes that are from their country of origin, but by God, if they arrived a week earlier, that strange bird is on their table. And there's something about that that connects them then to a broader, American culture for the most part. Not everybody. Some people don't like it.
Yeah. We have a caller here in Champaign. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for your guest. I happen to be a funeral director, and I would like your guest to comment on what her thinking is about when people try to avoid a ritual, either secular or religious, in the grieving process. What would be the prognosis for a family who tend to want to pretend that that event, the death of a loved one, didn't occur and don't bother to have any sort of mourning ritual, whether it be secular or religious? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. I see people mostly in a therapeutic context, so I do see people who've tried to do that and have gotten into difficulty. It catches up. It bites you eventually if you really, you know, we do live, I think, in a culture that tries to deny death. And so there aren't often very good ways to help guide people through, okay, this is the first Christmas since your mother died. How might you be able to do this in a way that both honors her and helps you to go on with life? Or if I'm imagining the caller also was referring to just not even doing any kind of mourning rituals at all. We have found it to be fairly problematic, and that people may then show up with symptoms of depression and not even know what it's about. And so rather than at that point, we do try to reconnect them to whatever that loss has been, and if rituals are then appropriate to help them to participate in such.
Yeah, I would just, I guess I was thinking after your example of the drive-by funeral, as silly as that might sound, it is a real thing. And I guess that one of the things I was thinking about is that it for people who have lost someone, the part of the idea of the funeral ritual is for them to try and work on accepting the idea that that person is not coming back.
That's right.
But I suppose for all of us in some larger way, it's also a reminder of the fact that that death is real. People die, you know, and it's one of those facts. We may not be entirely comfortable with the idea, but comfortable or not, it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you're going to die. Your kids are going to die. Your mom and dad are going to die. Everybody's going to die.
Right.
Which is something that a lot of the time we just prefer not to think about.
Yeah, no, I think that that's true. And again, I think that creating meaningful rituals in a context of loss can be so helpful and healing for people.
We'll try and get one more caller here, at least Urbana, line one. Hello.
Your comments about Thanksgiving reminded me of a favorite movie of mine and was featured at Roger Ebert's Overlook Film Festival this past year. It's called What's Cooking?
I love that movie.
Yeah, four different families, different backgrounds, trying to meld the generations and manage to get through family problems and or issues and celebrate Thanksgiving. And there's a lot to talk about if people wanted to watch it together. It's a good movie to watch anytime, but I really liked the portrayals and the way things came through.
Yeah, thank you. It's a terrific movie, I think, for people to rent and take a look at it this time of year. The portrayal of the different ethnic groups and how they make sense of a holiday like Thanksgiving. There's a gorgeous scene that just shows the food preparation in each family, an Asian family, a Latino family, an African-American family, and a Jewish family in Los Angeles. And it's quite wonderful. Thanks.
I'd also like to recommend the book Graces.
I don't know that.
In our extended family, there's a variety of religious and non-deistic practices, and it's hard to figure out how to do that part of family, the food family, the part where you sit down together. And so I'm thinking of, I bought the book for myself, and I'm thinking of taking it along with me and using some of the ones that might better fit my particular needs see what people's reactions are to it.
Sounds like a good idea.
There was one other thing I was going to say, and doggone it, now I can't come up with it. But thanks very much. I enjoyed your talk.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Well, in any case, I think we're at the point where we're going to have to finish because we've come to the end of the time. Any last thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
I hope people have the holiday that they most would like to have, and if they don't have it this year, that they can start to work on it for next year.
All right. Well, if you're interested again in exploring this whole idea of family and ritual, one book that you might look at is Rituals for Our Times by our guest Evan Ember Black and Janine Roberts, and it is available in paperback published by Jason Aronson. Evan Ember Black is director of the Family and Group Studies Program, professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, also a teaching faculty member of the Ackerman Institute for the Family. She's here visiting, her visit sponsored by the Pamper Chef Family Resiliency Program here at the U of I. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.